Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our meeting today. Thanks to all of the fellows who have led us. Jason mentioned earlier a number of activities that are coming up. One of them is a ladies' retreat also. We hope the weather is a little warmer than this weekend for our young ones. Look forward to the service tonight and hope you can be with us for that occasion as well. As Jesus was on his way up to Jerusalem to offer his life up for all of us, he told stories about life. Four of the parables that Luke especially records have an obvious theme, something to do with life in them, and we have decided for this, the rest of this month, that we would be looking at these four stories. Last week we read the story of the neighbor from Luke chapter 10. And this morning we want to read the story of the farmer. This farmer is better known as the foolish rich man, a way of referring to him that may cause us to take him more for granted and to overlook the lessons in his life than we should. This is a story, the story of the rich man, which has within it an obvious keynote of life. The phrases that the whole thing turn, the whole wider context turn on, have to do with life. Your life consists not of, Jesus will say. Your soul is required of you, the parable will say. The application of it will say, for your life is more than. And you can fill in some of the common blanks. And it will end you'll have a treasure that will not fail. I hope you've noticed that the line of thought in the songs we've just finished singing, God has made us His treasure so that He can be our treasure, so that we can live lives that are full of goodness, and so that we can lay up treasure in heaven. That's what this whole parable, this whole story is about. Bob mentioned the gift the Lord has given to us. One of the great gifts that we've been given is the privilege of having a very high view of our own lives, and the gift of being reassured that our lives can be invested in treasure that will not fail, that our lives can be such that we're rich toward God. I'd like for us to think about why that's so for these few minutes. A good way maybe for us to consider this will be to think about why Jesus told this story, and then to think about what the story says, and then to consider for a moment how Jesus applied the story. All three things happen here. First off, why does he tell this story? And when you look at it, look back up at verse 13. There are three things that stand out. One thing, he tells this story because a fellow interrupted an important line of thought with a kind of an off-key question, which showed this guy doesn't get it. He's not paying attention to what really matters in life. This passage says that as Jesus was talking about to his disciples about not being afraid and about God caring more for them than the sparrows, and about the time when he would confess them before the angels of God if they'll stand by their confession of him. Suddenly somebody in the crowd says to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." There were customs and, in fact, legal arrangements at the time that provided for the dividing up of the inheritance. this young man obviously felt like his brother was not being fair to him in some way. And you'll observe here that he wasn't really asking Jesus to judge the case. He had already judged it himself. My brother is not doing right by me. What he gave Jesus while Jesus was talking about eternal things was a demand. Do for me what I want. Make my brother give me what I think is owed to me. Jesus tells this parable secondly because of who he himself is, the place he himself occupies, because of why he was present doing the teaching and why he was headed to Jerusalem at the time. Jesus said, verse 14, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" The word for arbitrator is more commonly a divider. Who made life into a game, and who made me the umpire in it, the referee? I am of higher place than that, and I have more important reasons for being here, and I'm at work to accomplish something far greater than you, of a part of the inheritance that your brother has. I want to give you a much greater inheritance than that. That's the second reason why he told the parable. The third thing is, he told the parable because of who we are. This is the most important, maybe, for the line of thought that follows. This is verse 15. He said to them, notice the fellow has asked him a question, but he says this to all the disciples, including you and me. "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Let's start at the bottom of that verse and work our way back forward. One's life, my life, or your life, doesn't just consist in the total amount of possessions that we have in our grasp at the time. Our worth is not determined by our net worth. And our life is about something more than how much stuff we can gather together and how long we keep it and how it looks in other people's eyes. Those things will not satisfy or will not give the meaning that our lives deserve to have, that God gave to us and wants us to have. Therefore, covetousness is a dangerous problem. Covetousness, translated greed sometimes, is a form of idolatry that makes us think that if I just had more, then I would be happy. If I just had more, then I would feel good about myself. If I just had more, then my entire destiny and future would be secure. Both Ephesians and Colossians call covetousness or greed idolatry because it worships and serves the elusive more, then that would be enough. And this is such a common threat to us and such a prevalent temptation that Jesus has to say in two different ways we need to be careful about it. He says, take care and be on your guard against all of that kind of thing. It's one thing the first day of the week might help us do is to kind of refocus, and while we're thinking about the God who comes first, to kind of reassess and make sure he really does. Jesus told this parable we're about to read because of that fellow's question, because of his own mission, and because of what our lives are about. Now, what does he say in this story? It's a simple story. You could probably sum it up. You could tell it in your own words, maybe. But think about it for a minute. I'll just read it, and then we'll comment maybe a phrase at a time. And he said, it says here, and he told them a parable, saying, The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to restore my crops, or to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? Now that's the parable. And then there is one verse of commentary on the parable. So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Now think of that, what Jesus says here for a minute, and then maybe even what he doesn't say, and then gather up the point he's making. In this story, there is a man who farms land. The land of a rich man produced plentifully. He gave his land, along with God's rain and God's sunshine and the nutrients God put in the land, all brought forth plentifully, a bumper crop. A rich man has even more in this way. Notice in verse 17 beginning, he assumes himself as the owner, controller, and possessor and object of all of that all that's been produced. He thinks to himself, what shall I do? I have nowhere to store my crops. And then he becomes preoccupied with his projects and his stuff and his enjoyment. Maybe you noticed as I read the parable how many times my and I. One writer who counted them says there are four my's and eight I's. And that probably tells you the focus of the passage, doesn't it? This fellow is looking at the entire thing simply through the lens of himself. He thinks of what all of this means to him. He thinks very little of his life and what his life should be about, or of his personality, or of his relationship with God, his soul, or other people and their needs and the good he could have been doing in that way. None of that seems to cross his line of thought at this point. He takes a view of the real life as being one where you just relax and eat, drink, and be merry. When those types of things are done as the temporary season for refreshment in life, that might be one thing. When they're thought of as an entire philosophy of life or a purpose of life, then they look altogether different. He lives for everything that means nothing when his soul is required of him, which in this story happens. God said, not the rich man, but God said to him, this night your soul is required of you. Fool, whose will these things be then? I found one comment about this that made me stop and think. This is commentary by Craddock. Be careful not to caricature the farmer and thus rob the story of its power of realism, he says. There's nothing here of graft or theft. There is no mistreatment of workers or any criminal act. Sun, soil, and rain join to make him wealthy. He's careful and conservative with it. But if he's not unjust, then what is he? He's a fool, says the parable. He lives completely for himself. He talks to himself. He plans for himself. He congratulates himself. And his sudden death proves him to have lived as a fool. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits his soul, himself, his personality, his life? That's what Jesus taught himself in Matthew 16. So be sure to notice about the rich man. He's not evil. He's foolish. And his soul is required of him not as punishment. God is not trying to get at anyone who is wealthy. But his soul is required of him because that's how life is. It is of all of us eventually. And the problem is not that he's rich. The problem is that he's not rich toward God. Do you see that? In verse 21 in this passage. That's what Jesus is saying. It's a problem when you value being rich in every other way but being rich toward God. You'll miss what your life is about. Your life is more than that. Now that brings us to the application that Jesus made of this parable. And this is one of the things that gets missed. Jesus did make an application of the parable in the verses that immediately follow. These verses stand on their own as being wonderfully beneficial because of the answer to anxiety that they offer. But when they're attached to this parable and when they're understood as how to be rich toward God, they take on their true meaning and especially benefit us. How do we go about being rich toward God? We value our lives as being about something more than the ordinary things that occupy humanity. Food, clothing, as important as those things are, or to the rich man, eating and drinking and being merry. Comfort and pleasure and relaxation. That type of thing. Let me just read you how Jesus goes ahead to say this to his disciples. He says, "Value. Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, nor about your body, what you will put on. For life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They have neither storehouse nor barn." Now this, see, you compare this to the parable, you see what he's saying, of how much more, and yet God feeds them, of how much more value are you than the birds. To the rich man, this would have been saying, you're worried about your barns? God feeds birds who don't have barns. Like he's feeding you out of the soil that brought forth plentifully for you. Value yourself more than the stuff you have or the things you use in everyday life. Secondly, accept yourself as you've been made under God's rule. This is a crucial one too. Under God's care and under God's rule. Verse 25, "And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to the span of his life? If then you're not able to do such a small thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin," meaning They don't spin yarn and make clothing and turn it into cloth to make clothing. They don't have to dress themselves up in that way. Even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these lilies. But if God so clothes the grass which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will He clothe you, O you of little faith? He might have said that to the fellow who was asking, make my brother give me my part of the inheritance. And then the next thing Jesus says, this is the third one, set yourself on the pursuit of God's rule, of God's kingdom. Set yourself on what Jesus came to establish in the world and to bring about for us, the privilege of being under the rule of heaven. I might read now verse 29 following. And do not seek what you are to eat or what you are to drink, nor be worried. For all the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek His kingdom, and these things will be added to you. And then look at the reassurance. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. I remind you again of what Bob said at the Lord's table. Jesus was in the process of giving Himself because it was the Father's good pleasure to give us His rule in our lives. Conduct yourself in keeping. Sell your possessions, give to the needy. Not meaning it's wrong to have private property, but if you're in the spot of this rich man, then use the gifts you've been given. Provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And there is the lesson, the fellow who asked Jesus, tell my brother what he has to do for me, needed to hear. There is the lesson that the rich man needed to know. Where your treasure is, your heart will be. Your treasure gets there first in a lot of ways. And this story of the foolish rich man confronts all of us with the question of where our hearts are. What matters to us? What do we think life is all about? When I was a junior in college, I met Brother Joe Barnett, and I've always followed his things that he's written. I like to close this study with a piece that he wrote on what will matter. I think it fits this story. Ready or not, one day it'll be over. There'll be no more sunrises, sunsets, or birthdays. Positions and possessions will be history. Whether you lived in a castle or a cottage will be irrelevant. All you accumulated, both treasures and trinkets, will pass to someone else. Your proficiency, polish, and pedigree will be meaningless. Successes and failures by which your significance was calculated will no longer matter. Your resentments, anxieties, and irritations will be gone. Also, your hopes, ambitions, and plans. What will matter? How will the value of your life be measured? And in what I'm about to read, I want you to notice not just what he's saying about what won't matter, but also the reassurance that some things will still matter. What will matter won't be your competence and charisma, but your conduct. What will matter won't be how well you were known, but what you were known for. What will matter won't be the impressiveness of your resume, but the quality of your character. What will matter won't be how important you were, but how important you made others feel. What will matter will be that you said or did something that made a difference for someone. What will matter won't be how high you climbed, but what you did to empower and enrich and encourage somebody else. Not what you got, but what you gave. What will matter won't be whether you won or lost, but that you had the courage and integrity to do the right thing. What will matter is how you'll be remembered by those you loved and who loved you. What will matter is that you'll be missed because you filled a space in someone's life that no one else could fill. What will matter will be how deeply those who knew you will feel the loss when you're gone. What will matter won't be how long your life lasted, but how long your influence will. What will matter won't be how you started, but how you finished. What will matter won't be the name that identified you, but the actions that defined you. What will matter won't be things that happened by accident, but things that happened because of deliberate choices you made. Most of all, what will matter is that you committed your life to the Lord and will now hear Him say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord. Inherit the kingdom prepared for you." That's what'll matter. A great gift of the parable of the foolish rich man is the chance to think now about what matters and to let ourselves become rich toward God. That possibility is amazing grace. Have you confessed the name of Jesus and been united with Him by obedience to the gospel? And could we help you in that way? If so, let us know while we stand and sing.